Here we're going to look at semiochemicals. You might want to review from the second level course the mini lecture from that course, which I'll link on the PDF or on the website. Just to outline the lecture, we're going to define semiochemicals. I just noticed a spelling error there. The nomenclature for signaling chemicals, which covers allomones, chiromones, cinnamones, as well as pheromones. We'll look at a little bit of the research history on pheromones and their evolutionary origin and focus in on some examples, butterflies, and we'll also look at social insects. Lastly, we'll just touch on the applications of pheromones to insect management. Okay, semiochemicals is the term. Semio meaning signaling and chemicals. They alter the behaviour or the physiology of the receiver, so they're very much focused around emission of odours or some other chemical and the ability to detect whatever that chemical is. So it's very important to be aware of the sensory side of semiochemicals. Semiochemicals can be divided into pheromones, which involve intra, meaning within species signaling, intraspecific. And there are two categories, chiromones and allomones, which involve interspecific signaling. Chiromones, the responder benefits, allomones, the sender benefits. Now, they cover a broad spectrum. We're looking at it from the perspective of the viewpoint, so it's very much insect-plant because so many insects feed on plants, but these semiochemicals cover the spectrum of animals. Okay, just to reinforce that definition, semiochemicals can act interspecifically between species, and there they can be either allomones, where the emitter is benefited, chiromones, where the receiver is benefited, and cinnamones, where both achieve a benefit. And pheromones are intraspecific interactions within a species. And they can, as I said, they can come from plants or other animals. Okay, pheromones are the messages between animals of the same species received by another, and they trigger a response. Now, on the left-hand side here, you can see a classic example is the silk moth, where the female, you can see she's in a what's called a calling pose, where there's, you can see parts of the terminal abdominal segment are extruded, and that area is glandular, and she's releasing volatile chemicals. And the male on the right there is orienting towards the female to mate. Now, it's just out of interest, there's a lot of talk about human pheromones and their importance, but you can even buy products that are purportedly male pheromones. But there's a very interesting book written called The Great Pheromone Myth, where the author rubbishes most of the research that claims to indicate that there are pheromones in humans. Pheromones are very important in other mammals, like mice, for example, but the evidence on human pheromones is pretty scant. Okay, just a little bit of history. Pheromone is a word that most of you would know, but it was only ever invented in the late 1950s, and it's based on the Greek word pherein, to transport, and hormone, to stimulate. So a pheromone is a hormone that acts over distance. The very first pheromone to be characterised is one called bombycol, found in the silk moth sex pheromone, because silk moths could be produced in huge numbers. They were used for silk production. And so that enabled these researchers to get access to many, many thousands of individual insects and use complex chemical isolation techniques to isolate the chemical. It's called bombycol because the genus name of the silk moth is Bombyx, Bombyx mori. They found bombycol as the primary chemical component, but more often than not, there are multiple chemicals involved in any single pheromone. We tend to think of pheromones as primarily olfactory stimulants, but it's becoming more and more important and recognise that contact pheromones are very important amongst a lot of insects. So the contact pheromones are detected by gustatory receptors. In Drosophila, in the mating process, there's contact between males and females, and that's where the male recognises the female and vice versa through their gustatory sense. They've actually got specific gustatory receptors on the legs that detect the opposite sex. Methods in pheromone research, we won't go into a lot of detail, but behavioural assays are crucial to identify the pheromone. On the arrow one there indicates a glass tube, a Y-shaped tube, and it was important in the isolation of bombacol to take all of the fractions and test them as they were progressively fractionated for their ability to attract males. And the way to do this was to place pheromone in a solvent on one side of the Y tube and solvent only on the other tube, and allow a male to come in through the long arm of the Y and determine which direction it went. And one had to take care to do controls with solvent on both sides, etc. Also, finding the glands that produced it, you know, just their behaviour is indicating that the glands are probably located on particular tissues. And so you can do histology, extraction, dissection and extraction from those glands, and behavioural tests. You can do electrophysiology, recording from the antenna as odours are wafted over the antenna to see if the antenna produces more action potentials. That's called an electroantennagram. And it's the summed electrical potentials of all the olfactory receptor neurons. Gas chromatography combined with mass spectrometry is also very important in isolating pheromone components. And GCEAG stands for gas chromatography combined with electroantennography, so that you can detect the electrical response of the antenna at the same time as the fractions are coming out of the gas chromatograph. So it's a nice way of isolating the active components. And as I mentioned, pheromones, olfactory pheromones especially, have multiple components. Let's think about the evolutionary origin of pheromones. There's a couple of scenarios on this slide. On the left-hand side is one where the release came first and the ability to detect and use it as a behavioural orientation cue evolved later. Let's imagine, say, in a fish, let's say urine was produced and there's no specialised detection or response in the opposite sex, but you could get an evolutionary move towards being able to detect that urine in the water to allow, say, a male to find a female. So there's some olfactory or gustatory cue is there, released by an organism, and it over time there's an adaptation to home in on that cue and use it as an orientation cue. The other side of things is that the emission came first. Look, there's an example there where the female feeding on the plant releases a chemical, and the male adapts an ability to home in on that chemical, and that puts pressures on females who are might be feeding on that chemical to actually sequester it, meaning store it, and or release it in special glands, so that then a plant-originating chemical has been seconded into the animal's signalling system, because insects that are eating a lot of a plant are going to take in a lot of the chemicals in that plant. Let's just look at some work done on pheromone components. Now, the main components are taxon-specific, meaning that within any one genus you will see similar chemicals being used as pheromone components. But this graph is interesting because it shows the components of an aggregation pheromone in two genera of beetles, Dendroctonus and Ips. I think they're bark beetles. And you can see that there are similarities and there are differences. If you first compare the two genera, you can see that the component frontalin is found in all Dendroctonus but not in any of the Ips. So that's a major phylogenetic difference between the two genera. Now, you know, insect genera are seen as relatively closely related. species within genera, though, if we look within Dendroctonus, you can see that all have frontolin, but there's various combinations of all those other chemicals, and you'd be flat out to find two species that have got exactly the same components. On top of this, as we'll see in the next slide, also the concentrations of the different components can vary between species. If we now look at the right side, Ips, you can see that Ips dienol is found in just about all of the members of the genus, but there are different combinations of the other chemicals. So this just shows the diversity of components of pheromones. And as I said, variation in the ratios of blends between very closely related species can change. There's probably been a lot of selection pressure for species specificity in pheromone blends, just as there is species specificity in behaviours, especially mating and reproductive behaviours. So the relative proportions of the components, even if all the components are identical, but their relative proportions will be different between species. So it leads to a lot of specificity in the pheromonal signal. Butterflies and moths use sex pheromones. The silkworm that we looked at before is a moth. There's some interesting morphological and gland-related work done in butterflies. If you've ever seen two butterflies in the pre-mating stage, a male will flutter over a female. A female might have landed, or they'll also do this when they're in flight, depending on the species. And the male emits, using hemolymph pressure, pushes out these terminal structures called hair pencils, feathery-like structures. So they're normally kept inside the abdomen. When he's trying to mate with a female, he'll evert the hair pencils and they come out like the fingers of a glove. Now, they're covered with hairs. And in fact, those hairs are believed to be modified sense organs, that a sense organ has lost its neural structures and has become purely a secretory structure, elongated in length, and that the cells at the base of that structure are releasing the pheromone component that then flows along the hair pencil, because they have quite a detailed architecture when you look at them with the scanning electron microscope. So the male then, by having this huge surface area associated with these hair pencils, has a large pheromone emitting area, and he'll brush the female with this, and that helps continue the mating process. Also, in some species, there's like cuticular dust that comes off the hair pencils. The cuticle is sort of fragile so that it breaks off, and they're carrying odours along with them. In some male butterflies, they've brought in a second component. They have hair pencils, but as well they have these structures called androconia on the wings. The photograph here at the top is a macro photo of the wing of a male butterfly, Heliconius, I think. And you can see that there are some very sort of finger-like hairs in a certain location. They're called androconia. Scanning electron micrograph in the bottom, not of the same species, shows the morphology of those hairs. They're very ridged, able to have a very large surface area, and very, very different to the regular scales shown on the left-hand side. So the androconia also are the source of pheromones. There must be gland cells beneath them. And in monarch butterflies, there are actually androconia lie in pockets where there's like a recess in the cuticle where there are pocket scales and cushions that are versions of these androconia that look a little different. So the pheromone is released into there, and then it's released to the outside. So different species have various different specific modifications of androconia to produce and release pheromones. Okay, allomones are, to remember the meaning of allomone, I always think alarm allomone. And there are many examples. One of the most famous is the bombardier beetle. And there's a link through the website and your documents to a few videos showing bombardier beetles releasing this incredible spray of toxic chemical at very high temperature. And they can actually aim it as well. So it's quite amazing. Bottom right, there are cup moths. They're quite common in around Brisbane. The caterpillars have these spines that they can evert, and they're very sharp-tipped. And if you've ever brushed up against them and been stung by them, you know that it's quite painful. And actually, there's a project going on at the moment that I'm involved with. We're looking at the morphology of these spines and trying to characterise some of the toxins that are emitted by these spines, because it's a promising area for biomedical research, is to look at the constituents, because sometimes venom and toxin constituents have useful medical values. Top right there is a stink bug. If any of you have citrus trees, you'll probably be familiar with the citrus stink bug. Quite a foul smell. They have a very large gland in the metathorax that releases these chemicals that have a very strong repugnant smell. But it's got quite a bit of citrusy smell associated with it as well. Chiromones are chemicals that an animal will release in its everyday life, but either a predator or a parasite has homed in on using these chemicals as a way of finding that plant or that animal as a host. There are some complex stories about plant-insect interactions where plants are producing antifeedant chemicals, but then over evolutionary time, the insects evolve a way of no longer being repelled and then actually using it as an attractant. So there are multiple trophic interactions. Tritrophic interactions is one where the plant releases chemicals to produce parasites or parasitoids that might then remove the predators themselves. And a classic example also is in blood-feeding insects, such as mosquitoes and midges. They use components of our breath, CO2, some sweat components, lactic acid, other chemicals such as octanol that we emit, and they use that to home in on us to find us for a blood feed. Cinnamones is a smaller category where there's a mutual development of the signal and an ability to receive it where both benefit. Now, the classic story is plants emitting sweet smells to attract insects. And it's sort of remarkable to me the way we say that flowers smell nice and insects use them as attractants as well. Why do humans have this subjective emotion to say that this is a pleasant smell? It could perhaps be associated with fruit smells and then secondarily gone into flowers. But not all cinnamones are sweet. There's quite a lot of foul odours that are used by plants to attract insects. Stinkhorn fungi are an example. And quite a number of plants actually put out quite foul smells to attract carrion flies as pollinators. And the carrion flies also get a feed out of it or get some sugar. So there's many examples. We can divide pheromones into two classes as well. We can call them releaser pheromones, and that's mostly what we've been talking about so far. You know, they're involved in things like mate recognition, but also alarm, the allomones, aggregation. Many insects aggregate, especially immatures. Say, think of bugs on plants. Very often after they hatch, they stay together in a group. And that's an aggregation pheromone, is smelling or tasting each other. Territorialism, oviposition pheromones are common, where one insect will lay eggs and it might have a repellent pheromone that then stops other females from coming in and laying at the same place. But there might also be aggregation pheromones for oviposition, where think of blowflies, where the actual larvae do better if multiple females lay in the same spot. Recruitment pheromones, kin recognition pheromones, nest building, etc. Primer pheromones act over a shorter time frame. They alter the endocrine, reproductive and nervous systems, and there's an example on the website and in your PDF of cockroach going through reproductive cycles, where the glands that the female uses in the reproductive cycle also expand and contract through that cycle. Social insects are famous for using a lot of pheromones. You know, they've been termed as walking gland systems. They have many different glands and many different locations on the body. And that's because of the crucial nature of communication in social insects. Social insects have characteristic that siblings are to get, stay together. They give up the right to reproduce, and they show castes, different behavioural traits associated with the caste that they are in. So this is primarily regulated by pheromones. If we look at some diagrams of pheromones in wasps, bees and ants, termites as well, you can see the diversity of pheromone glands. Labial glands are primarily salivary glands, but they are also seconded into becoming pheromone releases in many insects, especially the social insects. There are a number of head glands, mandibular glands, propharyngeal glands in ants, hypopharyngeal glands in bees. The hypopharyngeal gland produces royal jelly that the workers put into the feed the immatures that are going to become future queens. That are associated with the stings. There's venom glands, Defoe's glands, there's Nasanov's glands, there's all sorts of different glands. And they have many different behavioural and physiological outcomes. In ants, they antennate each other. If you've ever watched ants going along a trail, when they bump into each other, they might spend some time touching each other's antennae. And so they're detecting a hydrocarbon template. And if it's not the nest mate, doesn't have the same hydrocarbon template, you'll get aggressive behaviour. When bees sting, they release a pheromone associated with the glands adjacent to the sting, and that alerts nest mates. So if you get stung by a bee in close proximity to a beehive, the rest of the bees can come out and attack you as well. So it can be very, very dangerous to be stung near a hive. So that's an alarm pheromone to bring the rest of the bees out. Recruitment pheromones and trails are very well known, though I won't go into any details here. The termites are also social insects, and they use pheromones quite a bit as well. They have a phagostimulating pheromone in the labial glands. Phagostimulating means stimulating feeding. And they release this labial glands secretion while they're chewing on food, and that itself stimulates nest mates to start feeding and chewing at the same spot. So it's a recruitment feeding pheromone. Just very recently, the genomes of Blattella and three termite species have been sequenced and compared. And part of the rationale for doing this was to look at what happens to the genomes in the process of eusocialization, becoming truly social. Termites are truly social, cockroaches aren't. And some of the differences that are emerged, I'll just go through them. One of them is that the ionotropic receptors, if you go back to your section on sensory receptors, you'll see that the ionotropic receptors are one of the types of receptors, and they are more diverse in basal insects than they are in the more like the Hymenoptera, Coleoptera and Diptera, those that have radiated and once they've been able to feed on plants, etc. So the ionotropic receptors, they're expanded in both the cockroach and termite compared with Hymenoptera, which is the other group that has eusocial representatives. Another point was that the eusocialization in termites is not associated with the evolution of new genes. It's not as simplistic as saying, oh, well, they evolved a whole lot of new genes and that allowed them to become social. That's not the case. Similar genome size, similar number of genes. It did emerge that there's an increased importance of the cuticular hydrocarbon communication in the termites, and that's most likely associated with the maintaining of the caste system, that the cuticular hydrocarbons are important signalling amongst the termite community to make sure that the individual insects develop into the appropriate caste and they are maintained in that developmental role. When they looked at the olfactory receptors, they were differently expressed between workers and queens in termites at a higher level than between nymphs and adults in the cockroach. So the olfactory receptors came under a lot of regulation in the transition to eusociality, and that's once again associated with keeping the caste system. Queens of honeybees, Hymenoptera, they produce a mandibular pheromone, and the attendants around the queen, they consume this pheromone, share it with the rest of the colony, and that signal tells the colony that they do have a queen. It also has a secondary function in reproduction, in that the male drones, when they go out, they form these congregations, and when queens fly through that congregation, the females release this mandibular pheromone, and that causes the males to then track that female and try and mate with her. And the males have a massive concentration of sensilla placodia, olfactory sensilla, on their antennae compared to the worker. Like a drone has 30,000 sensilla placodia on the antennae, whereas there are only 3,000 on a worker. They're those flattened plate-like structures there. Okay, last I'll just touch on the importance of semiochemicals in pest control. Some of the advantages are that they're highly selective because, as we mentioned, pheromones tend to be species-specific. So it's really very high selectivity compared to using, say, an insecticide. And they are non-toxic, so if you can disrupt mating using a pheromone, because they're not killing individuals, they're just confusing them, you'll delay the onset of resistance. Plus, semiochemicals are relatively short-lived and they're non-polluting. That relates to the fact that they're quite selective. So they have a number of advantages, but... and especially in mating disruption, where in the diagram at the top right, you can see that a pheromone can be released from fruit trees by a grower can hang up these little sachets. And what it does is it confuses the males if they want to orient to a female, because they get multiple odor trails. And so their orientation is completely screwed up. They suffer sensory fatigue, and the natural plume is just not detectable for them. And that has been successfully used in controlling bollworm, oriental fruit moth, and there are many, many more examples. But they are only successful under certain conditions, usually when the insect has a short lifespan, a synchronized mating period, and quite a short mating period. So growers can put out these pheromone dispensers at an appropriate time. And if mating is restricted to a short time, then it can have a big effect. But there are many cases where pheromones can't be used because, for example, if just a few males escape the pheromone effect, then that they can inseminate many females. There are sticky traps linked up with pheromones as well. You can put them in your kitchen cupboard if you've got meal moths or other moths in your pantry, and there are many, many products available. And there are many more being developed as pheromones are being isolated and characterised.